Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, February 26th. I'm Ray Graff. Time again for the Science Forum. The group is assembled, and they're ready to answer your questions. Got a couple emails already at voxpop@wamc.org. But if you want to call in, well, it's a call-in show. 800-348-2551 with your science question. 800-348-2551. It's all about science today. Is something bugging you? You're trying to figure it out? Well, the experts are here. 800-348-2551, or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. The Science Forum, your calls coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's time for the Science Forum. The experts are here to answer your question, so if you have one, this is the time. 800-348-2551 to call in with yours. Or if you're the shy, retiring type, you can write us an email, voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org. Don't write 10 pages. A couple paragraphs is good. Or you can call us, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. All right, that's it for the introduction. Let's have our team of experts sign in, please.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's Barbara Brabetz. I teach biochemistry and biology and chemistry at SUNY Cobleskill.
You reminded me a little while ago, you're still on sabbatical.
Yeah, I've got one half of a semester left to go. So I'm knee-deep in research and no papers to correct.
What are you researching again?
I look at water quality on the Mohawk and the Hudson Rivers, and we look for sewage infestation or influxes.
So when you're knee-deep, you're really knee-deep.
Yeah, well, you know, thankfully it's figuratively this time of year.
Oh, yeah. And then you, who are you?
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist. I used to work at GE R&D, but I've been retired now for about 10 years.
How are you feeling? You feel more relaxed every day?
Oh, yes.
Yeah? Oh, that's so good. And then you?
I'm Ed Stander. I'm not a chemist.
What happened? You got a little head cold from the kids at the school?
Yeah, every time you correct a piece of paper, you've got some more bacteria coming in your system.
That's a shame. And that's why Barbara is feeling fine.
Exactly.
That's right. I got a smile on my face and all of my immunity.
But now you're in a room with Ed, so bets are off.
We'll see. We'll see what 27 years of teaching at Cobleskill gets me as far as immunity.
All right. Yeah. The number here is 800. What didn't work for Ed? 800-348-2551 is the number. It's a science forum today. A lot of emails already. I know that Jim has some cool stuff that he did research on beforehand. Let's hold off for a minute because we have some follow-up from Nick. Remember we had a scintillating email about...
Yes, Nick and coffee.
Yeah, the coffee maker and distributing the qualities of the different coffees. And he says, the side-by-side coffee in the machine is a game-changer. Now I sometimes put in three types. It distributes the nice qualities of each evenly. It was fascinating about the bottom one adding more essence. I thought the opposite. I wish I could remember most of that last show, but there you go. But Nick, of course, has some questions. Do microwaves kill germs?
Yes, if they go hot enough.
Does a microwave oven kill germs? Let's put it that way.
Well, I mean, it has to be on, but yeah, the presence of a microwave oven in the kitchen does not do it.
That's right.
But it has to work on something and heat it up beyond the lethal temperature for the bacteria.
And that's the trick, because most porcelain, for example, does not get heated up in a microwave. So it has to be something that actually gets hot.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, let's assume the porcelain is already clean. Right? Like you're not taking a dirty plate that the dog licked and then putting it in the microwave with a piece of pie on it and heating it up, right?
That's disgusting. That's
what I do. It works.
Thanks for that image. He also says, how hot does water have to be to sterilize a surface?
Well, sterilization's a different animal altogether. We really, for the most part, need to get pasteurization, like to the point where it's hot but not super, super hot.
Yeah.
Sterilization usually requires temperature and pressure, and you're not going to get that in a microwave. So like when you use like the sterilized cycle on the very fancy Bosch dishwasher, it's not really sterilizing because in order to get sterilization, you need high pressure and high temperature.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
and you're not going to get that in anything that doesn't have like a pressure vessel.
And if you use high pressure and high temperature, it allows you to get the water to a higher temperature before it boils, which is the
right.
basic
and,
idea.
And it allows the steam, too, to penetrate bacterial membranes or viral capsules.
Yeah,
that's
so
kind of the, you know, the most pathogenic, the most resistant to death, I guess, or to inactivation, require that you're going to penetrate that heat inside the cell. Not, oops.
Whoa, that's a good one.
Whoa, yes. My microphone did the number five thing.
Let it be noted that has been doing that since 2017.
It feels like it's yesterday.
All
yeah.
right, well, we'll
but
get
anyway,
on, we'll get
I,
on
I think
it.
It's telling me to stop. Talking.
Okay. So, well, Jim, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I was just, you know, if you're trying to sterilize surgical instruments, then you need to do the pressure bit in an autoclave.
Yeah, 15 minutes for, at 15 PSI above normal pressure for at 121 Celsius.
But as far as for normal household use,
right?
You know, hot, steaming hot water for a few minutes should be enough.
Ed, you're not feeling well. Have you thought about pressure steaming the papers that you receive from the kids?
Oh, I thought about pressure steaming myself, actually.
Nice idea. During COVID, we were worried about what to do because we didn't understand how much of a fomite, how much of a transmissible item the virus was on paper.
Yeah.
And there was initial thoughts that it needed to be exposed to air for something like 2.5 hours before it could be considered disease-free or not transmissible. And so we were putting them into BSL-2 hoods, which are biosafety level 2 hoods. We're putting the papers out and then turning a UV light on, leaving it on for 20 minutes, and then flipping the paper over, hitting it for another 20 minutes, and doing that in stages so that we could get to grading papers. Because, you know, when we told students, we're going to have to leave your papers out, you know, in the cold for a couple of days until we're pretty sure it's COVID-free.
Right.
They didn't like that. I mean, they wanted the instant gratification of a grade, you know, this week.
I mean, couldn't they have just electronically sent it?
Yeah. A lot of times I would scan them with my full gear on and then grade the stuff once they were scanned.
Oh, but there's viruses as well in computers. You've got to be careful.
Ah, very well
Can't
played.
Can't sterilize them with
All right,
pressure.
Final question from Nick. And because he's asking about washing clothes, I thought this is perfect science for him. Does washing clothes in cold water work as well as hot? Same amount of soap. And Nick says, I have a bet on this one.
Well, we have had this question before, and believe it or not, this got to fight, it's not almost shouting in my household.
So oh, yeah?
I'm a cold water person because I know many of the commercial laundry detergents were designed to be used in cold water. So they have enzymes in them that have been engineered by Procter & Gamble and other companies that are in the cleaning business to be best activated at low temperatures.
Well,
because
tipped.
Most people don't want to pay to heat their water to use it in their laundry.
Ah.
And in Europe, it is very much verboten, as I use my German.
Oh, wow, nice.
Unless you had something that needs, quote-unquote, sterilization, right? So it's designed to be used well in cold water. However, my husband insists that he must use warm water.
Well, let's dredge up that domestic battle again. All right,
Jim, did you want to add anything about the cold water?
Pretty much what you said. It all depends on the detergent. I mean, back in the good old days, you had to use hot water. But
yeah,
chemistry has improved.
Let me tell you a Brabets hack that I've got going on.
Okay.
Two of the pieces of recycling I hate the most, and this isn't laundry detergent, but you get my drift, is cleaning out the peanut butter jar and the mayonnaise jar.
Right.
They're awful. What I now do is I sacrifice a little bit of laundry detergent or half a pod or whatever for my dishwasher and throw it in there and just let it sit in cold water for like a day, and then I pour it out and it's squeaky clean. Because the enzymes have a chance. You don't really need the agitation. You need the enzymes that are made for this purpose of chewing on organic matter to either solubilize or break up the fats that are in there.
Why don't you just eat all the peanut butter?
Well, again, that's probably another fight in my household.
Okay, fine.
But
I don't
go all
Let's
the way.
Let's just move on. Here's another weird one. It's the Science Forum today with Ed Stander, Jim Pickett, and Barbara Brabets. And this is from Jane in Lee. Several years ago, we woke up to a huge bang at 3 a.m. When we came downstairs, we found that the glass shower door had exploded into pieces, so many and so small, we had to pick them up with a snow shovel. Evidently, it's a phenomenon and usually occurs between 12 a.m. and 4 a.m. The door had never been nicked or banged before the explosion. Any thoughts, panel?
Okay, we examined the things on YouTube about...
You're telling about that, that we're
tempered
cheating.
Glass.
You're cheating. Don't tell them that. You just came up with this.
Oh, okay, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. The shower doors are made out of what's called tempered glass,
right?
Which has had a pattern of stresses put into the glass.
Yeah.
So that when it breaks, it will break into lots of little pieces.
Yeah.
Rather than sharp. Shards.
Right. And mostly square pieces so that they're not pointy.
Yeah.
Like that's the point.
But there's a point at every corner of a square piece.
They kind of break rounded a bit and then they pulverize in between.
And it's 90 degree points, so it's not strong points.
Being a chemist, I've had my share of broken glass.
Yes.
And untempered glass, you don't
want to mess with that.
Mess with that.
Well, the video is quite something of these shower glasses, but the 12 a.m. to 4 a.m. is not a thing, right?
No, not the time of day. It's easy to have scratches in there that you're not necessarily aware of, and those are stress concentrators. So then if there's additional stress on the door, or it could be the crack was growing, or it could be that there was a flaw in the glass as it was made that makes a spot where any stresses concentrate.
So do you think it was a vibration in the house or something that caused this?
It doesn't even need to be, really. It doesn't need to be a temperature change or anything. But remember, these are hanging in some way, a shower door. So there's probably a hole that's already been engineered, at least in two of on one side, upwards and downwards. And so we have introduced an extra stressor in that there is a hole that has already been placed in the glass door so that the hinge can hang on it.
It's funny. This video said, well, one way you can limit the damage is to have this plastic coating on one side of the glass, the side that's not near the water, the other side, which keeps it all together even if it shatters.
But it already has. It already is an Oreo of two pieces.
Oh, my gosh.
No.
Tempered glass is doesn't have a coating?
No. You know what?
The only laminated glass that you will commonly encounter is the windshield of your car.
Are we moving to six?
Why don't we move to Mike 6? You see, what happens is the Mike 5 has some, performance anxiety, and it droops at times. And we're going to try Mike 6 now. And one of these years, man, that's going to get fixed.
Okay, I think I'm on 6.
Yeah, in the case of windshields, for example, what you've got is exactly the same kind of glass, but you have a piece of plastic in between the two of them so that when the glass hits something, it breaks into the same shards, but the shards don't fall off.
Uh-huh.
Actually, I don't think the windshield glass is tempered.
No, it is. Because
it
I've
is.
Seen
it's
it.
Safety glass, right? They
pieces.
Call it that.
What? It breaks into the same small
No, it
pieces.
Is tempered because, yeah, we oh, for forensics, okay. we used to talk about the different types of glass.
Listen, I could talk about shower doors all day, but we're way overdue for a break, and we got to get to the phones. It's 800-348-2551. Adventures in Radio Today. Jim Pickett, Ed Stander, and Barbara Brabets. It's the Science Forum. We'll be back. Isn't that nice? That's Tiptoe with Frank West and Thad Jones. 800-348-2551. The Science Forum here. Jim Pickett in good health. Barbara Brabets in excellent health.
Stop it.
Ed Stander, he doesn't sound so good, and now we're all going to get sick. But that's all part of the fun of learning. 800-348-2551. Let's go to Ed in Salt Point. Ed, how you doing?
Doing well. Thank you very much for taking my call. My question is, in organic or any chemistry for that matter, but we'll say organic chemistry, what is the force that causes bonding? And in reverse, what is the force that debonds, chemically speaking?
Okay, the chemical bonds are, in organic chemistry, the chemical bonds are shared electrons. So the electrons are in orbitals around the nuclei. So it's electrostatic forces that hold everything together.
And often they're trying to go from a situation that's not ideal to a more ideal. Like we're trying to drive a reaction in organic chemistry to allow the configuration of which electrons are shared with whom to change, and they want to upgrade. And that usually will cause a reaction, like a bond to form. And we can disrupt that force, that electrostatic force, right, Jim, by throwing in some other energy. Like you could use UV light, or sometimes you can use heat or even shock waves to break a bond. It's not that the bond is necessarily unstable, but you just need to destabilize it enough to stop the sharing.
Yeah.
Is electrostatic force a version of electromagnetism?
Well, it's not magnetism. It's electric fields. It's more like what static electricity is than what magnetism is.
Ed, go ahead.
Where I'm heading is in terms of the four basic forces of nature, electromagnetism, gravity, weak force, and strong force. Which of those, if any, is the chemical bonding related to?
Electromagnetic.
Okay, that's all right. So yep. It's a variety. Electrostatic is a subspecies, as it were, of electromagnetic force?
Yes.
Okay, yes. Fine. All right. And the forces that would disrupt it could be anything or would be also electromagnetic forces?
Yeah, it's usually electromagnetic force of some kind, because if one way to break the bonds is by shining light on it of the proper frequency, that will be absorbed by the molecule that provides the energy to break the bond.
Oh, cool.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much.
Ed, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551. If you have a question on the Science Forum, 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop on WAMC.org. While we're on the topic of light, all right? Barbara, you might know about this. I watch a lot of late-night TV, and there are these ads, and people put on these freaky-looking masks.
Oh, like the red
goalie.
Light mask
to
grow your hair now?
What does red light do? Please let me know.
You know, we don't really know.
Ah.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes.
We can measure experimentally and with controls, positive and negative controls. We can take tissue, live tissue, and even cells that are not disembodied, like growing in a flask.
Right.
And we can shine red light on it, and we find that their regenerative and reparative properties go faster.
No way.
And it's so funny because we're not, we're terrestrial animals and all that, but we need light for stuff, right? We're not cave dwellers, but red light has been shown even to stop, slow male pattern baldness.
You're kidding.
So some of these red light mask things that they put on people's faces, not over the eyes, people, to help slow hair loss and all that, it has some minuscule effect. I don't know if it's enough to take your late night dollars. And I don't know.
Don't worry, I don't have any late night dollars. It'll be fine.
But red light therapy has been working over about the thickness of the skin, and then the top layer of muscle just under the skin.
Amazing!
It is. It's fascinating.
So, theoretically, then we know all these LEDs, TV screens, there are a lot of blue light involved. Could there be detrimental effects from light as well?
Well, there have been shown that sleep can be disrupted by blue light in particular.
Yeah.
Even with your eyes closed. So blue light is a little bit more energetic than red light. And the frequency of red light, not all red lights are designed the same. There are certain frequencies of red light that seem to have this regenerative effect more than others.
Yeah. Okay.
But the blue light certainly does throw off your circadian rhythms, it looks like.
Yeah, I could.
Is it just a matter of the red light being able to penetrate deeper and warm things up a little bit?
Well, I do think that the blood flow is a piece of it, because red light is right, for the audience, red light is right next to infrared, which is heat, on the electromagnetic spectrum. So when you feel something that's warm to the touch, you're receiving infrared radiation.
Uh-huh.
As opposed to red light, which is right next to it, and you see it as red, it doesn't necessarily feel hot to you unless it's, you know, like
right.
a hot
well,
red light.
Well, but it's scattered, but it, it's scattered yes. less by the right. stuff in your
correct.
Cell.
Right. And
so,
it can so penetrate
it,
deeper.
So it penetrates deeper. Yep.
Follow-up question then. When I went to the Roy Rogers at the Thruway rest stop and all the burgers were under on under infrared light, if we left them long enough, would they go back into being a cow?
Would they grow hair?
Yeah. They'd grow hair for sure.
The number here is 800-348.
Depends on how cooked they are.
Oh, some good burgers over there. Let's go to Patrick in Warwick. Patrick, you're on.
Hey, how you doing? There's a commercial property behind me with a stormwater retention runoff pond for the big flat roofs and parking lot and surrounding landscape. They're currently dumping truckloads of snow in there. That retention pond dumps into the local Wayway on the creek.
Yep.
I'm wondering if those truckloads of snow are really acceptable under common zoning laws,
okay.
and if they're harmful to the creek by virtue of the volume that it was not designed for.
Patrick, thank you for not saying the name of the commercial entity that keeps
yeah,
us from getting
no
sued.
Problem.
All right, so Barbara, you first. You're the water expert.
Sure. So retention ponds are something that are built for commercial businesses when they're either rehabbed or built. These retention ponds go in order to handle the impermeable surface pavement and roofage, which normally does not allow any percolation into the soil. So the idea is it's going to give the water a chance of residence time in contact with natural soils to be able to be absorbed and recharge into the groundwater. And we, the number one month for flooding in the Northeast, New York in particular, is February. And the reason why is we have more light. Usually we have snow on the ground, as we certainly do this year, and we get these freeze-thaw cycles. The ground is really not penetrable at this point in time.
Right.
So whether the snow is sitting on a pile of mulch on the edge of the pavement or whether it's in the retention pond, for all intents and purposes, it's going to be traveling across the surface when it melts because the ground is still frozen. We're designed this way. There are downstream effects, literally and figuratively, with salt loading. Chloride and sodium, two components of road salt, have effects on the environment, both from a plant perspective, a microbiological perspective, and also from an animal perspective. And we've seen a lot of ecological changes in places that have been dosed with salt for 100 years,
okay.
To the point where we now have seaside grasses that grow along almost all of the Northeast's roads because they're salt tolerant, where the normal grasses that would grow alongside a road that's not salted have long since died off.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
As opposed to cattails.
Well, cattails are pretty tolerant, believe it or not.
Yeah.
They're being outcompeted by invasives, but it's not the salt that seems to do them
okay.
in.
Okay. Thanks, Patrick. Appreciate the call. 800-348-2551 or email voxpop@wamc.org. It's Barbara Bravitz, Jim Pickett, Ed Stander. And Ed, I know you haven't had a lot of questions your way now, and I think this one might be good.
Oh, thank you.
You ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
You want to do some calisthenics and get ready? Okay.
I'll just read a couple books beforehand.
All right, here we go. Ben in Puerto Rico writes in, can you explain how rogue waves happen in the middle of the sea? Where do they come from? Are they common or rare?
Whew. That's a large question.
Okay.
A lot of rogue waves are caused by shifts in the bottom of the ocean.
Okay.
Tsunamis as well occur in the same way. Large rogue waves, there's been a lot of studies done on it recently, and what generally happens is that waves follow a pattern. In fact, if you're on a beach, you can see it. You'll see one wave comes in, and then 10 seconds later, another wave, and then another wave.
Yeah.
Well, if that pattern gets disturbed by some reason, the waves become additive.
Ah.
And when they do, they become much, much larger, and as a result, they can cause a great deal of problems. So every once in a while, you get these rogue waves coming in, which are coming from possibly a different source, which are then additive with the waves that are already there.
But they'll happen in the middle. Like boats occasionally will be capsized by this.
Exactly.
That's really crazy. 800-348-2551. This email from James at voxpop@wamc.org. Subject heading, giant insects. If we could hypothetically build a giant environmental dome and could increase the oxygen content from our current levels of 21% up to roughly 35%, like in the Permian period, could we re-evolve giant insects? Jim Pickett.
It would take a long time. Evolution is slow. Theoretically, I don't see why you couldn't.
How giant are we talking about? I mean, I watched The Deadly Mantis the other day from the 50s, and it's a giant not a grasshopper, but a praying mantis.
Arthropod. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And well, so, but they can't be that big, right?
There are at least I've seen illustrations of these dragonflies in the Permian.
Yeah.
In the Permian period where—
Big as us. Yeah. As big as us.
But doesn't it come down to physics at some point? You can't get that big.
Well, what it comes down to with the insects is— getting oxygen in, because I think
you're right. It's getting oxygen in.
It's a matter of diffusing the oxygen through the outside of the body. In
they have these little spiracles along their body that allow oxygen contact with their tissues. They don't have the true kind of like distribution like lungs like we do. So the important organs need to have a high oxygen content, right? And you need some oxygen content for everything else. Yeah. So that's the what we think is the number one limiter. And he's trying to, your caller or emailer is—
Increasing the oxygen
to get rid of that problem. The other issue is it has an exoskeleton. And I think that's what you're getting to.
Yeah.
Like, how big can you be
and support
with
the
an
weight.
Exoskeleton?
I mean, the deadly mantis had to have been a couple hundred, few hundred feet high.
Yeah. And then what are you going to feed on? If you are megafauna— Right? If you're as big as a house, then you've got to eat like little houses every day.
See, and a problem of getting big, especially if you're breathing through your skin essentially, is that as you get bigger, your volume increases faster than your surface area.
Correct.
And so there's a limit.
Okay, there is a limit.
To how big that could possibly be.
But it was a suggestion that one of the reasons the dinosaurs got so big when they did was because of the higher oxygen content plus the higher temperatures.
Ah.
And they had an internal skeleton, not an exoskeleton like their insect neighbors.
So the last 40 years I've been worried about giant praying mantises is I don't really have to worry that much.
Yeah, we scientists, we got that one, you know, under wraps.
Thank you so much.
And you know that the praying mantis, they discovered that— if watched, a female praying mantis will attack and kill the male, which always bothered me a great deal. If watched during, if lights are on and people are watching this thing while the two are having a good time, then the female will almost always, at the end of it, bite off the head of the male.
But they won't do it if the refrigerator door is closed. Yeah, it's a quantum mechanics sort of thing. That's really, really weird.
So I wouldn't worry about
it. It's very stressful.
Fair enough.
The numbers, make sure the lights are off.
800-348-2551. Yeah, just a typical science form. Let's go to Holyoke. Sean, you're on.
Hi there. I'm talking in regards to refrigerant circuits. I was just curious on the science behind superheat, subcool, and latent energy, and I'm just going to hang up and give a little—
All right, hang on. Say them again because we have some raised eyebrows here, Sean. Say it slowly.
Yeah.
Superheat, subcooling, and latent energy in regards to a refrigerant circuit.
In regard to a refrigerant circuit, superheat, subcooling—
I don't know anything about this.
It's more of an engineering question. I think we— pure scientists would have a harder time. This would be more of a Roger thing.
Okay, so Roger is not here today, but if you want to bank that one for the next time he's on, Sean, we'll try to take care of that. That's interesting, though. Ed, you know a lot of stuff.
I do.
Can you fix a refrigerator?
Yes.
Okay, let's take a break. 800-348-2551. That's our number. Sorry about that, Sean. You've stumped the band, my friend. 800-348-2551 Science Forum. You know, it can't get much worse. We'll be back. John Weber here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551. Ray Graff with you, and it's a rollicking edition of the Science Forum with Ed Standard, Jim Pickett, and Barbara Bravitz. A couple emails here, and then we'll jump back to the phones. One guy on hold got struck by lightning, so we'll go to that one next. This is from Sarah in Saratoga. I have well water and live next to a farm that has cows. There are times when the cows are grazing approximately 10 to 15 meters from the well. When there are cows grazing, there are cows urinating and defecating. Mm-hmm. Should I have my water tested? And that's from Sarah.
Yeah, it depends on the depth of your well, but I would suggest that you have it tested, sure. Nitrogen and phosphorus loading and, of course, pathogens like, you know, the nasty things we were talking about at the beginning of the show are all susceptible. There are wells that are within even a mile of a farm are sometimes susceptible to those. So it's really worth the peace of mind to know that you're not loading with your body up with pathogens or excess nitrogen or phosphorus.
Yeah, to a good extent, it depends on how far it's lined. Most wells are lined these days to about 50 feet, which means that the materials coming from the cows would have to go 50 feet through the ground in order to get to the well. And during that time, bacteria are chomping away at it and effectively eating whatever they can. So the water could be good, but it really all depends on how good your lining is.
I often run into people who have very shallow dug wells that are in these historical houses. These days, I don't think you can even get a mortgage with a dug well anymore. So that's one of those wells that sirens should go off if you ever see that. And the second thing is if you have really rocky underground terrain, then what happens is the surface water will run basically in cracks between the rocks, and there is no bacteria to remediate some of that nitrogen and phosphorus we talked about. And so if you have that kind of rocky terrain, even if you have a deep well, you should still have it tested.
Fair enough. And yet they've been doing this for hundreds and hundreds of years, and people all didn't die.
Yeah, well, I was giving a cooperative extension course on water in your home, and I was talking about this, and a light bulb went off of one of the retired people who was taking the course, and he said, can we do a lab where we bring our water in and we'll test it? And I said, sure, we'll just go get the strips from the store. And, you know, the strips from the store are okay. They're like a good first step, but you should always really use a certified lab.
Okay.
Anyway, we tested his, and he lived right next. He was on top of an escarpment, but below him was farmland all around. But his well was 200 feet down, so it went beyond the level of the ground and then down a little bit more. We tested it. It was super saturated with E. coli.
Yeah, about that.
And he's like, gee, I wonder if my wife really has intestinal bowel syndrome or if we just are constantly being loaded with bacteria.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
And she went to a GI doc, and after they cleaned up their water, and her IBS went away. So
wowzers.
Her IBS was not IBS.
Wowzers.
It was constantly being loaded with bacteria from the farm.
Well, it's Medical Monday as well. Good job. Cherie writes in, I'm wondering why absolutely clean glassware gets very cloudy after sitting in a closed china cabinet for a period of time. I have a cherry all-wood china cabinet with glass doors. Every time I put clean glassware in, when I take it out, it's cloudy. And that's from Sherry.
I would wonder about waxes and things like that inside the cabinet, that the glass will get a static charge and will those things will wind up winding up on it.
Yeah. So the wax is from the wood, from the cabinetry.
Or it could even be just the very fine dust.
So interesting, though. I mean, how does magnetism take the wax from the inside of the wood?
Well, the wax volatilizes anyway, so it's already coming off. That's why you sometimes have to re-wax your floors or re-wax, that's hard to say, your cabinetry. Excuse me, but so it's already coming off, and then the question is, where is it going to land? And it's going to land preferentially on something that's charged.
The number here is 800-348-2551, Science Forum, and let's go back to the phones. The guy who got struck by lightning, let's go to Rick in Stockbridge. Rick, how you feeling?
I'm feeling good now, Ray. Thank you.
What?
Yeah, great show. I always love the science.
Thanks.
Shows.
What happened, man?
Back in 2011, we're having like a Florida downpour, and with thunder and lightning, the thunder stopped, and I just love the sound of the rain. So I opened up one of the sliding windows in my three-season room, and I was typing on the computer, and all of a sudden I felt something, it felt like somebody grabbed my wrist, my right wrist. And I looked down, and at that moment, a lightning bolt hit me right in the wrist. And my question, which I don't understand, for five or six seconds, from my wrist to my elbow, which was pretty much laying flat, it was arcing, like an arc about 18 inches tall, just a solid, and it was long enough for probably a second or so break, and long enough to me for think to myself, well, this isn't going.
Wow!
And it was like another couple seconds after that, and then it just kind of went around my back and actually threw me off the chair. I threw the chair backwards. I landed.
Good Lord!
And I was wondering what caused it to arc, and how come it barely even singed any hair on my arm.
That sounds like it's likely to have been ball lightning or St. Elmo's fire. That basically you got hit with a ball of plasma.
Wow.
Because lightning itself is very, very brief. But these kind of mysterious, weird balls of plasma that are not well understood because nobody knows how to make them in order to study them. So the only accounts are from people like you who suddenly encounters this weird phenomenon that they've never seen before. And so it's really been hard to figure out all these things.
Go ahead, Rick.
What I didn't mention, sorry to interrupt, it was actually a lightning strike. My neighbor, on that strike, it hit his house and everything that was plugged in, even his heaters and water heaters, everything was blown out. Televisions.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if it was a stringer of lightning off that.
So a lot of voltage, but not a lot of amperage.
Really long. Yeah, 5 to 6 seconds is long.
Yeah. Especially if it's kind of moving around. I don't think that would be classical lightning. It would be the St. Elmo's fire or ball lightning.
Rick, do you have any metal screws or anything in that arm or wrist?
I have nothing. Nope.
How'd your computer fare?
It was a solid wall of arc. I mean, it was definitely a plasma, like 18 inches. And I'm just watching this thing going, oh, this isn't going to be good.
So were you at a desk or was the computer on your lap? Because you said you were typing on your computer.
At a desk. Yep. With my arms resting on the desk. Yep. And it hit me right in the wrist.
Did the computer fry?
Yeah. Nope.
Wow.
Nope.
Yeah. See that? I think that kind of confirms that it has to be
plasma
versus a direct strike. I don't think the computer would survive that big of a jolt.
Well, the other possibility, though, is that the electricity hit the other house. Yeah, it's possible that the electricity that hit the other house bled into your house, which means that the
electric lines.
Yeah, the electric lines, which means that the amperage would have been cut way back by the time it got to you.
So,
and I've seen that happen. So my family's house got struck at one point in time, and I think we didn't have lightning rods, but we had I think it was an old antenna on the top of the roof, and it got struck. And lightning bolts came out of every outlet in the family room.
Wow, right.
Just shot right out. Wow. And, you know, that's not pretty.
Rick, the only thing that really perplexes me, well, many things do about what you said, but this business about feeling like your wrist was grabbed for several seconds beforehand. What is that?
Well,
that's understandable.
That's understandable because nerves have a certain action potential.
Before it happens.
Before and after. Milliseconds, you know.
He said less. How many seconds did you say, Rick? 5 seconds?
The whole thing lasted 5 to 6 seconds, but it felt like somebody slapped and grabbed my wrist. And at that moment, half a second later, I looked down and I saw the.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, gotcha.
So what happens is you're just overloading the action potential of your muscles. It's kind of like what they do with the paddles, right? When they zap you like on TV. So the muscles are all going to be stuck in kind of the action. And they can't relax until the electric potential goes down below a certain threshold.
Rick, thank you for the call. That's a great one. 800-348-2551. Let's go to Abigail in Kingston. Abigail.
Hello. I am so enjoying the show.
Me too.
I only got an 80 in my chemistry region.
Good for you.
Good.
That's above average.
which was pretty good at that time. But I want to thank you so much. This has been so educational. And that's what Vox Pop is all about. And Barbara, Robert Louis Stevenson said that marriage is a battlefield. So don't worry, be happy, and wash the clothes with cold water.
I'll give you my husband's email. You can send it to him.
Everyone. Ah, that's nice. Bye. Well, thanks, Abigail. Have a good one. We'll go to Noah in Germantown. Hello, Noah.
Who paid her to call?
She's very nice.
That was nice.
Go ahead, Noah.
Hi, am I on?
You betcha.
Thank you for taking my call. It's a great show. And I don't know if I'm going to be able to top the story about lightning.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
I have seen two praying mantises in an intimate embrace.
Having a little hey-hey.
At a nearby tennis court. And it was a perfect opportunity for me and my friend to stop playing tennis because we weren't particularly good. Anyway.
Okay.
So we watched them for a while because I had also heard that this legend that male praying mantises devour their mates afterwards. It seemed like a better way to spend time than
right. No, it makes sense.
So we watched for a while. And it didn't happen.
Oh.
They never unlocked. But when I got back home, I looked it up. And actually, there's only one kind of praying mantis that behavior has been observed in.
Oh.
And it's fairly rare. So I just wanted to call him.
Well, and the other thing is, you know, maybe she was playing around. Maybe she was already full. You know what I mean?
Yeah, the idea of why they eat the male's head is to gain more protein for the egg laying. So if you're protein full already, then you wouldn't necessarily need to eat your mate. Seems like a lot of bother for nothing.
She was snacking between meals, Noah, but thank you for that. 800-348-2551. Nona is in Ghent, or is it Nana? I don't know. You're on.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
More or less.
Okay. Yeah, I just had a question for the woman who was talking about the detergents and only needing cold water.
Right.
And because they have enzymes. And I'm just curious about what these enzymes are and if they're safe for the environment.
All right. Barbara Brabitz, what do you think?
Sure. They're enzymes that have been recombinantly manufactured. So they're new and improved, as Procter & Gamble would normally say. They're naturally occurring enzymes that have been engineered in not a Frankenstein way, but in a helpful way to work at colder temperatures and also be more effective at breaking down the tough stain stuff. So that's usually protein is tough to break down, and also oils are tough to break down. The more water soluble stuff is can just work by agitation, you know, like rubbing stuff together or even using like traditional soaps.
I understood. Yeah, I thought you explained it really well. It's just, I was wondering again whether they're safe for the environment.
Sure, they're biodegradable as well.
They're biodegradable.
They're meant to break down over time. So, they're not going to accumulate.
And if it's protein, something will eat it.
Yes.
Well, Nona, thanks a lot. Go ahead.
Go on. I was just going to say that's why there's still dirt out there.
Ah.
Yeah. Oh, why? My septic tank isn't just as shiny.
Shiny as clean as the day it was born, exactly.
Believe me, it's not.
800-348-2551, the Science Forum with Ed Stander, Barbara Brabitz, and Jim Pickett. And let's see, Susan writes in from Sunderland, Mass. My question is this. Is the outdoor temperature, as opposed to wind chill, the one we need to be concerned about regarding freezing water pipes?
No,
this comes
it's,
up at my
it's,
house.
It's wind chill. I do.
Yeah,
it's wind chill. You have to worry about taking the thermal layer away from the house, right? Your house has, in essence, its own kind of down coat around it.
Yeah.
And that there's going to be a temperature differential between the side of your house, if your house isn't like super, super insulated, and the outside. And when the wind blows, it's going to rip that heat away from that latent heat that's in your wall to get to your pipes to perhaps
it's
make
like,
it
freeze. It's like blowing on the soup to cool it.
Yes. Yeah, that's a great analogy on the radio.
And plus the wind will drive the cold air in through any
But the
cracks
pipes are inside, though.
No, depends on where you live. Like, I have my I seem to be like Miss Example 101 today, but my kitchen water pipes are under a window, of course, right?
Right.
In order to get to that window, the person who built our house, it was a kit house, apparently didn't understand this principle. So she ran the pipes down the whole outside of the house from the second story down to the first story in the outside wall to the kitchen sink. So we have a whole routine when it's windy and below 5 degrees in order to make sure our pipes don't freeze.
All right. Fran in Gallatin writes in, being struck by lightning. Lightning hit my DirecTV dish, traveled down the wire into the house and took out the DirecTV box, but nothing else. I was in the sunroom about 10 feet from the DirecTV wire into the house. I felt something and fell to the floor.
Ooh, that's tough.
Yikes.
Yeah, well, the DirecTV box is probably protected. It probably has something in there which is keeping the electricity from getting from there into the rest of the house. And the electromagnetic power of that can send out for quite a ways.
Hmm. Okay. Jeff and Troy writes in, superheat. Remember we talked about that? Superheat is any amount of heat above the threshold temperature of phase change. Subcool is any amount of heat below the threshold. Latent heat is the amount of heat required for the phase change, also referred to as either the heat of liquefaction or the heat of vaporization.
Yeah, because that's how AC units work and how heater
and refrigerators
work, too, is you've got a phase change between liquid and gas, and that phase change is allowing you to remove or add heat.
Yeah.
All right.
But what that has to do with choosing...
I don't remember the question, Jim. I'm sorry.
The part of the question that why anybody who is not the refrigeration engineer would have to worry about those.
Okay. Well, I think Jeff is one of those engineering types, so this probably comes up from time to time. Very quickly, let's go to James in Niskayuna. James, you're on.
Yeah, hi. Back in the 70s, two times on a ridge above the Troy Hudson River area, I saw a blue light across the sky, and it was hundreds of feet long, and it went up into the sky like northern lights come down out of the sky. So it was a big bar of light, and it spun on a corkscrew up into the sky and disappeared. But it was very long. It was like a city block long, and it was two times over the course of 2 weeks. And it didn't look like a sprite. It didn't look like a laser beam because it was solid on both ends. It was like a giant lit up neon bulb that rotated up into the sky.
What time of day was it, James?
It was late at night.
I don't know.
And were there storms or was it clear?
That's what I was thinking.
No, both nights were clear nights. In fact, mm-hmm. The first night we were near the water tower at Tibbetts Avenue. And there was a nuclear research facility at RPI at the time, and I thought maybe somebody was playing with a laser beam, but I've never seen something so large, and I've seen lasers back then.
If you would have said that it happened more recently, then I would have told you it was one of Elon Musk's Starlink.
The corkscrew sounds sort of like a rocket launch.
This was just above the treetops. It was very close to the ground, or it seemed very close to the ground.
Yeah, it's very hard to judge.
You said a block, a block wide? Is that what you said?
At least a block, maybe even a quarter of a mile, but it was over a long row of trees, and it went up into the sky. It didn't touch the trees, of course. But
could it have been a transformer?
When
transformers blow, they tend to blow pretty blue.
Yeah.
But it would kind of sputter.
Colored blue.
Yeah, it would sputter
and
more.
Not sputter. It looked like a solid beam, like somebody took a blue fluorescent light and corkscrewed it up into the sky.
Sheepers, I have no idea.
Huge. And I've tried so many times to find anybody describing, and when sprints came along and when they started seeing those, I thought it might be one of those, but it was not truncated like a tree trunk or a lightning bolt.
Yeah, sprites usually require lightning at some distance away that caused that to happen.
Did anybody else see it?
Yeah, the first night there was like five or six of us that saw it. The second night I was driving on the same road, and it was like 2 weeks later, and I saw it out my side window.
I've seen northern lights that are columnar.
Yeah. Oh, you're right about that.
That appear to go all the way to the ground, but they don't seem to travel. I mean, they do move, but corkscrew. I don't know.
Traveled upward, though.
The rocket idea is not that bad.
No.
Because it's very, very difficult to judge
distances.
Distances heights. And sizes of things up in the sky.
I got to say, we've had some great calls on this program today. This was a good one.
Stump the panel.
Well, Ed Stander, you've got work to do at school, so I hope you're feeling all right.
Yeah, and I'll look for blue sprites and see what I can find.
I thought that was a great call. Jim Pickett, enjoy the bingo game or whatever it is that you're going to do. Barbara,
I follow my wife around and give her helpful suggestions.
Oh, I'm sure she loves that.
Of how to do things better.
Grand, yes. And Barbara, enjoy the rest of the sabbatical.
Thank you. I'm going to go do some water quality in Florida for a couple weeks.
Support comes from Waymo, working to build a future of safe, accessible transportation through autonomous vehicle technology designed to expand options for people unable to drive. More at Waymo.com. Well, thanks to Ed, Barbara, and Jim for being here. Thank you for listening. Tremendous calls today. Fun show. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Susie Checkeye screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, Nisa Waheed joins us, and we'll talk about food for Ramadan. We'll see you, too.